And today is Tuesday, May 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Now, coming up, a new United Nations report paints a bleak picture in North Korea.
The report finds that, in effect, this threat of arbitrary arrest and the harsh consequences that follow provides state officials with a powerful means to secure bribes.
Also, we have an update after a man stabbed and killed two people outside Tokyo, Japan, and we learn about a new method for capturing carbon to improve the environment. Those stories and more are all ahead on today's International Edition. According to a new United Nations report, North Koreans eking out a living in the country's thriving informal private markets are regularly subjected to corruption and various forms of human rights abuses. Daniel Kalunge, a United Nations human rights officer, provided details of this report.
The report finds that the state, rather than ensuring this activity can take place in a safe and secure environment, has instead maintained a legal grey area where people remain exposed to arbitrary arrest, detention, prosecution and imprisonment for engaging in these activities. The report finds that this becomes a source of further human rights violations that extend beyond the violation of the right to an adequate standard of living.
North Korea's state-run rationing system collapsed in the mid-1990s amid a devastating famine and economic crisis, leading to the creation of unofficial commercial markets in the socialist regime. The report by the UN's Office of Human Rights says the failure to legitimize these markets has exposed ordinary North Koreans to significant risks.
The report finds that, in effect, this threat of arbitrary arrest and the harsh consequences that follow provides state officials with a powerful means to secure bribes from a vulnerable population seeking to eke out an existence through rudimentary market activity. The financial hardships of a struggling population are thereby compounded, as money is extorted systematically to support state officials.
The UN report was based on interviews with 214 North Koreans who have defected from the regime and resettled in South Korea. The report blames the situation on the priority the regime places on supporting its military and developing its nuclear weapons program over adequately providing for its people. But what has this report shown us over previous reports? For that, I spoke with Greg Scarlatu, executive director at the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea.
The report confirms findings of the UN Commission of Inquiry, and the report also confirms findings by civil society organizations such as our own. This is a report based on new interviews, 214 first-hand accounts of escapees gathered by UN staff in Seoul. And basically, the report validates some of the key findings of human rights organizations. It is very important to remember that the Seoul office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights was established pursuant to a recommendation made by the UN Commission of Inquiry. It is very important that the UN, through its Seoul office, continues the investigative work of the UN Commission of Inquiry.
Greg, is there anything in the report that you perhaps disagree with?
It's an excellent report overall. There is one aspect that I do not agree with. The report refers to the public distribution system. It accurately states that the public distribution system collapsed during and after the days of the Konane Hengun, the Great Famine in the 1990s. But it also quotes authors stating that the public distribution system worked properly under Kim Il-sung. I disagree with that statement. We have to remember that the public distribution system depended on one's Songbun social classification. And Songbun is mentioned in this UN report as well. How much does the government, or did the government, give people? Based on what? Based on their jobs. But their jobs in turn depended on their Songbun status, which in turn depended on their perceived level of loyalty to the regime.
Now, rights groups such as yourself and others have been sounding alarm bells regarding the situation in North Korea for some time. But in your estimation, what progress has been made on getting aid and improving the conditions in North Korea thus far?
Well, first of all, aid should be contingent upon several very important factors. Whenever aid was disbursed to North Korea, one major concern has been access to the most vulnerable, access to those who need humanitarian assistance the most. Another serious concern has been monitoring, the ability to monitor the disbursement of humanitarian aid from the port of arrival to the point of distribution. And I argue, like many others, we do need monitoring actually to the point of consumption. What progress has been made? The UN Commission of Inquiry report, this report by the sole office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, certainly validate findings pertaining to North Korean human rights. This is a stark reminder that this is a regime that prioritizes nuclear weapons, missiles, keeping its elites happy, which all help maintain the regime in power, while sacrificing the human security of its own people. As Michelle Bachelet herself put it, referring to this report, the rights to food, health, shelter, work, freedom of movement, and liberty are universal and inalienable. But in North Korea, they depend primarily on the ability of individuals to bribe state officials.
In terms of moving forward, your report documents what the situation is. Were there any recommendations contained within it on how to improve the situations for those living in North Korea?
Well, these are not new recommendations. Basically, the report accurately describes how grave the human rights situation is. The report recommends that many of these issues be tackled, and the report, just like the UNCOI report, you see, we often forget that the UNCOI report was about more than just accountability, crimes against humanity, referral to the International Criminal Court. The UN Commission of Inquiry also included a set of recommendations amounting to a roadmap to reform, openness, positive change in North Korea, very much along the lines established by the UNCOI report. This report itself recommends a set of reforms that would be in everybody's interest, including the interest of the DPRK government and of the international community.
And that was Executive Director at the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, Greg Scarlatou. Attacks on schools in Afghanistan tripled last year compared to 2017, the first time attacks on schools had increased since 2015. The AP's Charles Deledesma has that story.
The United Nations Children's Agency says one reason for the spike in attacks is that militants targeted schools that were used as polling stations in the country's October parliamentary elections. According to UNICEF, the number of attacks on schools went from 68 in 2017 to 192 the following year. The agency also says Afghanistan's conflict and deteriorating security situation left more than 1,000 schools closed last year, and that 500,000 children were denied their right to education. I'm Charles Deledesma.
A deadly knife attack took place at a bus stop just outside of Tokyo, Japan. According to officials, the perpetrator killed 2 and injured another 16 before killing himself. While Japan is one of the lowest crime rates in the world, it has also had a series of high-profile killings, including in 2016 when a former employee at a home for the disabled allegedly killed 19 and injured more than 20 others. For more details about this attack, I spoke with Tokyo-based reporter Gavin Blair.
Before 8 o'clock Tuesday morning in a relatively quiet suburb of Kawasaki, which is just south of the river that separates Kawasaki from the capital, Tokyo, a man believed to be in his 50s carrying 2 knives attacked a group of school children who were waiting for their school bus, girls, all young elementary school girls waiting to take them to school. The man who died is believed to have been a father of one of the children and is understood to have been an official at the foreign ministry. We presume he died attempting to protect his daughter and the other children there. And that's all we know at this point.
Has there been any indication from authorities as to why this occurred? Because these attacks really don't happen with any kind of frequency.
That's right. The violent crime rates in Japan are very low. Unfortunately, there's no clue as to his motivation. After he attacked these children, killing one man, one 11-year-old girl, and injuring a number of other children, 15 or 16 other children, he then stabbed himself in the neck. He had lost consciousness by the time ambulance crews and police arrived, and he died shortly afterwards in hospital. So it's possible we'll never know what his motivation, whatever such a motivation for an act could be, was.
Since this attack was at a bus stop with children, you know, you mentioned two people were killed, 16 others were injured. How are people in the area reacting to this simply because of the rarity of violent attacks?
Right. It is, of course, a shock. I mean, violent crime is not unheard of. It is extremely low in Japan. Shootings are almost unheard of because of the extremely strict gun laws. Random stabbings do happen occasionally. There have been a few in recent years. This was particularly upsetting because it appeared that these young girls were deliberately targeted. Inevitably, people are scared. The school shut down. That school shut down for the day, and a number of people mothers and grandparents were seen taking the children from school and taking them home by train. Other schools in Tokyo also shut down early for the day, so inevitably there's fear after something like this happening.
And that was reporter Gavin Blair in Tokyo. Now, following the attack, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe described the fatal stabbing spree as harrowing, adding that he is outraged and will take all necessary measures for children's safety. U.S. President Donald Trump has offered his sympathy to the victims of the mass stabbing attack and has concluded his four-day state visit to Japan and is in the process of returning to Washington. Here are some other major stories from around the globe. New satellite photos show significant damage to Syrian villages and surrounding farmland as a result of government offensives and the last rebel-held stronghold in the country. Brazilian authorities say at least 40 prisoners were killed in four jails in the northern state of Amazonas Monday in what appears to be gang violence. And Iran's Revolutionary Guard said it does not fear a possible war with the United States. Tensions between Washington and Tehran soared recently over America deploying an aircraft carrier and B-52 bombers to the Persian Gulf over a still unexplained threat it perceives from Tehran. You'll find these stories, expanded coverage, and more at our VOANews.com website. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Leonardo da Vinci is known today as a renowned painter, architect, inventor, and scientist. Known for painting the Mona Lisa and the Last Supper, da Vinci, according to various historical accounts, was also a procrastinator and left quite a few unfinished projects and works of art, such as his Adoration of the Magi and perhaps even the Mona Lisa itself. A new theory proposed by Professor Marco Cattani, a researcher from King's College London, might provide an explanation for this behavior. Cattani says the great da Vinci may have suffered from attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. Admitting that while it's impossible to make a postmortem diagnosis for someone who lived 500 years ago, Cattani expressed his confidence that ADHD provides the most convincing and scientifically reasonable theory to explain da Vinci's difficulty in finishing his projects. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. forecasters are warning of the risk of more severe storms across the central part of the country on Tuesday, including the possibility of tornadoes in the area that saw several spawn there Monday night. The National Weather Service reported a string of tornadoes across eastern Indiana and western Ohio overnight, with storms around Dayton, Ohio, damaging many homes and leaving roads impassable. In Indiana, Madison County Emergency Management Agency spokesman Todd Harmsman says the damage from the storm has been wide-ranging.
We're seeing damage everything from tree limbs to a front porch gone to trees completely into homes. Outbuildings, secondary-type garages that have trees into them, utility poles into them.
And to that end, authorities are still assessing the aftermath of those storms from Tuesday. Harmsen says residents of Pendleton, Indiana, should stay inside, if possible.
We just believe at this time it is not safe. We do not want people to be driving or walking around in the town of Pendleton due to power lines still being on the ground.
Now, speaking to WKEF and WRGT-TV, storm survivor Dale Hassler says everything he had ever heard about tornadoes turned out to be true.
Everything that they ever said about a tornado was really true about it sounding like a freight train coming through, and very, very frightening.
The central U.S. has been dealing with severe thunderstorms and tornadoes since last week, with storms blamed for deaths in several states, including Missouri, Oklahoma, Iowa, and Indiana. As the stormy weather plagued the central U.S., several cities in the south have seen record-shattering high temperatures. Over the weekend, Augusta, Georgia had a 141-year-old record high as the temperature topped 36 degrees centigrade. Savannah, Georgia tied that record for the earliest occurrence of temperatures over 37 degrees in the city, and Charleston, South Carolina and Wilmington, North Carolina all hit 37 for the first time ever in May. Meteorologists predict the scorching trend will continue, and high temperature records will be set in the cities of Louisiana all the way through to Virginia. By contrast, instead, the sunshine and warmth, California got hit by a rare late May snowstorm, bringing record low temperatures. In the mountains of northern and southern California, surprise snowfalls have extended the ski season. Mammoth Mountain Ski Resort has announced its plans to stay open into August. Israel moved closer to new parliamentary elections Tuesday as lawmakers voted in favor of the first of three procedural moves necessary to dissolve the current parliament. The 66-44 vote set a tentative date of September 17th for a new election if the measure makes it through the final two rounds of voting. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been unable to form a new government since his party won the most seats in an election last month. He has until Wednesday to reach a coalition deal with other parties or risk having Israel's president give someone else a chance to form a coalition government. Netanyahu is unlikely to allow that to take place, preferring to take his chances in a new election. His prospective coalition has been thrown into turmoil by former defense minister Avigdor Lieberman, who has demanded passage of a new law mandating that young ultra-Orthodox men be drafted into the Israeli military like most other Jewish men. Netanyahu's ultra-Orthodox allies have called for the current draft exemptions to remain in place. Late Monday, Netanyahu called for his potential coalition partners to put the good of the nation above every other interest to avoid what he said would be an expensive, wasteful election. The Israeli leader said he was hopeful that a compromise could be forged before the date on Wednesday for him to form the new government. Enhanced military cooperation between the United States and Japan in the face of a rising China was emphasized as President Donald Trump concluded his four-day state visit to Japan. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman has been traveling with the president and filed this report before leaving Tokyo.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe hosted Trump on the deck of one of Japan's helicopter carriers that is to be converted to carry a short takeoff vertical landing variant of the F-35 supersonic jet fighter. In their remarks, the two leaders did not mention China by name, but Abe spoke of an increasingly severe security environment in the region. And Trump noted Japan is to purchase more than 100 additional F-35 stealth jets from the United States that will help our nations defend against a range of complex threats in the region and far beyond. There has been nervousness in Japan about America's long-term commitment to the defense of the island nation, especially with the presidency of Trump, who had a longtime reputation as a Japan basher. Trump's latest visit to Japan is seen as easing some of those concerns, although trade frictions persist. Steve Herman, VOA News, Tokyo.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition. Chinese telecommunications equipment maker Huawei is reviewing its relationship with Federal Express after it claimed the U.S. package delivery company, without a detailed explanation, diverted two parcels destined for Huawei addresses in Asia to the United States and attempted to reroute two others. Reuters' Grace Lee has that story.
how does a package addressed to Huawei in China end up in the United States? That's what Huawei wants to know, and it's accusing FedEx of tampering with its mail. According to the Chinese chipmaker, FedEx diverted two of its packages from Japan and even attempted to reroute two others from Vietnam, all without authorization. The two packages instead ended up in Memphis, Tennessee, FedEx's headquarters. The company showed Reuters images of FedEx tracking records, though those images haven't been verified. It wouldn't say why it thought the packages were diverted, but the company is at the heart of a growing trade battle between the U.S. and China. Washington believes Huawei, the world's largest telecoms equipment maker, is a potential espionage threat because of its close ties with the Chinese government. In mid-May, the U.S. government effectively banned American companies from doing business with them, though Reuters hasn't found evidence linking that to the FedEx incident. FedEx claims the packages were misrouted in error and that the company wasn't requested to divert them by anyone else. When shown the tracking records, FedEx refused to comment, saying company policy prevented it from disclosing customer information.
And that was Reuters reporter Grace Lee. The idea of pumping excess carbon
Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an exclusive interview with the Prime Minister of Buganda, Charles
The idea of pumping excess
is the largest, most influential.
The idea of pumping excess carbon emissions underground has been around for a while. As the process gets cheaper and more practical, scientists are testing new ways to lock away these greenhouse gases. VOA's Kevin Enix has this story.
This is a different kind of carbon capture experiment. It's taking place in an abandoned mine in Switzerland, near populated areas. Most carbon capture is done in uninhabited areas and deep under sea. But these scientists are testing to see if a saltwater carbon mixture they are pumping into a clay and rock fault line will stay put.
If this rock have a fault in it, is it possible that CO2 comes up through the fault? This is what we wanted to answer.
If the test is successful, it could make it cheaper for countries to dispose of their excess carbon by storing it underground in their own backyard.
CO2 underground storage already exists, but in almost uninhabited areas, such as offshore areas, deep down in the sea or in desert areas. What is new here is that if one day we want to stock CO2 in Switzerland, which is a densely populated region, we need to make sure that the CO2 will not migrate into the surface and contaminate, for instance, drinking water sources. This is really one of the major stakes here.
Environmental activists like Matthias Schlegel with Greenpeace are generally supportive, but say the world must not only engineer its way out of the problem, but also keep working to reduce emissions.
What worries us is not only that these technologies are being developed, but to see that in the meantime, the necessary efforts needed to limit greenhouse gas emissions are not being made, and that should be done in parallel. We should massively reduce these emissions. Given the fact that we will have to resort to these technologies according to the GIEC, there is a need to develop them, but the effort should be placed on reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Computer models predict the Earth's average temperature could rise between 1.8 and 4 degrees Celsius over the next century, with devastating impacts. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
And that is going to do it for us today. On behalf of the amazing director that we have behind the glass, Patrice Martin, and the incredible director, or engineer rather, Patrick Dea, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, videos, stories, and more, you can follow VOA on social media. You'll find us on Facebook, Twitter, and of course, Instagram. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile app, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a terrific Tuesday.